This bridge building lecture, Challenges of Coexistence by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, was arranged and recorded by Muslims in Dialogue of Denmark.
والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى آله وصحابته ومن تبعهم بإحسان إلى يوم الدين. First of all, if there was only a two-day notice because that's all I was given as well. And when I was invited to come here by the NBC people, who are a film crew that came from Saudi Arabia, and their intention was to try to actually help increase the communication, and I was happened to be with one of my teachers, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, and I asked him what he thought. He said it's wajib. In other words, it's not something you have to go. It was as simple as that. So he told me to go. And so here I am in Copenhagen, and I think what's really intriguing about everything is that everybody in the world knows that you're here. And before these events, really nobody was aware of Islam in Denmark. And it's a small community, but obviously it's had a major impact now for a number of reasons. First and foremost, I want to say that my view of Denmark was always informed by very positive qualities, because Denmark is yearly one of the least corrupt countries in the world. When they do the corruption index, it is one of the least corrupt countries in the world. There's an immense amount of transparency in the Danish community, and that is something that is really very Islamic. I hope she's not dissenting with me on that. that's something, but don't worry about that. It's good to hear a baby cry. And European birth rates are declining so rapidly. I'm happy to know there's still some babies in Denmark. The other thing about Denmark for me is I happen to be a lover of Soren Kierkegaard. And I really wish he was alive to comment on this current situation, because he had an immense amount to say about the declining impact of religion on people's lives. And it was something that distressed him greatly. But one of the things that he did say is that the root of all evil is boredom. And I think there's an immense amount of truth to that statement, that one of the real tragic aspects of the modern age is we love stimulation. We love these events that create an immense amount of stimulation. And the media thrives on these things, you see. And really, at the end of the day, an immense amount of blame, as far as I'm concerned, is placed on the media. Because this began as a media event with cartoons that were published in a media, which is the print media. And in turn, the global media blew this event out of proportion, amplifying it, and suddenly we're dealing with all of the fallout. You see, this is what happens. And I really believe that the media has so much responsibility for not just this event, but so many of the tragic events that take place. And many of the people working in media have no idea of the type of impact that they have. Many of them are very cynical and really shrug their shoulders about these things. And so I really feel that increasingly we are going to have to deal with the phenomenon of a globalized media and how freedom of speech and responsibility, which is really at the crux of this issue, how freedom of speech and human responsibility can be reconciled. Because one of the things that one of the great American chief justices said was, it's not freedom of speech to shout fire in a crowded theater. In other words, with freedom of speech goes responsibility.
And so it's very important that we are acutely aware of how often, and far too often, our responses are elicited by the media. I'll give you one example. Right now there is a major humanitarian crisis in Niger. Very little is being done about it. Why? Because it's not in the media. The tsunami, which was a major media event, elicited a massive response from all over the world. Money, concern, care. Nothing's changed in Indonesia. If you go to Indonesia today and go look, people are living in very, very dire conditions. But all the donations have gone down because the media's moved on to another interest, another target. You see, Pakistan right now, an immense amount of human suffering going on after the earthquake. It's just not that important. It's not very high up on the media's priorities. Do you see? I mean, there's a distracting media that is interested in the midriff of Britney Spears or whoever the latest, whatever you want to call them, I don't know. I'll try to be polite tonight. But there's that media, you know, this media that's obsessed with celebrities and what's happening. And then there's the media that's concerned with the global issues. But the global issues are entirely determined by editors. I'll give you one example. I had an interview with Reuters. And it was a reasonably extensive interview, but I mentioned they asked me a couple questions about Iran, and I gave a few answers. The next day, the entire interview was framed around Iran. And I asked the person who interviewed me, because I knew him, why was the interview framed around Iran? And he said, well, Iran was at the top of our list that day. And so the editor said, did he talk about Iran? And he said, yes. And he said, frame the story around Iran. So there's an example of a story completely determined by an editorial process. So I really feel that we, all of us, in many ways, are victims of a very small group of people, media personalities, pundits, the talking heads, that really have an inordinate impact on our lives. And we need to question that, because part of the problem is people are bored. They don't know how to sit alone in a room, so they turn on CNN to see what's happening. Or BBC, or what's the station here?
Denmark's Radio.
Yeah. So you can turn on that, and then they'll tell you what's happening in the world. That's not what's happening in the world. Babies are being born. People are dying. I was just in a house in East London where we went to visit a man who was sick, a Muslim man. And he was dying of stomach cancer. 31 years old, four children, and his wife was pregnant. We went to visit him 2 days ago, and I found a man who was starving to death, literally starving to death. And I trained as a nurse. I'm a registered nurse, and I worked in an intensive care unit. And I said, why isn't he on an IV solution? And they said, because we were told by the hospital, it's just prolonging the inevitable. And so they don't pay for it. And I said, well, he should be on a drip. He should be getting some, all he was taking was water. And it was going on for weeks. He was literally starving to death, which is a criminal act in the United States. That should be news. I mean, I think people should know about that, because a country that considers itself to be civilized should not have situations like that happening. And to say it's only prolonging the inevitable, well, maybe his children have a right to have him around for a few more months. So there's an example. It's not a news piece, but when the woman in Florida who had her tube pulled out, it was international news. And this goes on all the time. So part of it, I think, is that we need to stop being manipulated by these news agencies And the Muslims in particular have become pawns in a really wretched game here. Responding just as expected and giving an immense amount of gratification for people that are trying to elicit these responses. Because they enjoy watching these things happen. They derive some perverted pleasure out of doing these things. It's exciting and people get bored. So the inability to just sit in a room, which was obviously one of the hallmarks of a pre-modern society, when you couldn't open up a window to the world to see people rioting in Karachi. I mean, people forget in Baghdad, in Iraq, Imam al-Ghazali was teaching at the height of the Crusader occupation in Palestine. And one of the criticisms that some of the modernists make against Imam al-Ghazali is that he didn't talk about that. Because that was not his concern at that time. Because one of the things about intelligent people is they concern themselves with things that they can do things about. They don't concern themselves with things that are happening in far off places. Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the American philosophers, said he hears people constantly going on about the slaves in Barbados, and they're doing nothing to alleviate the wretched conditions in their own neighborhoods. You know, our concerns end up being in far off places, and we forget about what's going on in our local areas. What should we be doing? As a Muslim community, one of the things that we should be doing is helping people to understand who we are. And we have to ask ourselves that question. Have we been doing our job? In Denmark, have the Muslim community been doing their job in terms of reaching out to the larger community to let them know who they are as a community? Most people in this society don't even know what we believe in, our basic tenets. And religion is no longer high up on the list. In the West, it's just not, it does not have the priority that it still has in many other parts of the world. So this is one of the major problems. Now, in terms of what actually happened, I think in a lot of ways, and I could just give you a short story to elicit this. And this is something somebody told me that after 9/11, the Pope wanted to get rid of the Muslims in Italy. So the head imam went to the Vatican and said, you know, you can't do this, we need to have a dialogue. And so the Pope agreed to a debate, but he made a condition, it had to be a silent debate. So the imam and the Pope met, this is just a story. The imam and the Pope met, and the first thing the Pope said, he went like that. And the imam said, and then the Pope went like this. And the imam went like that. And then the Pope brought out the Eucharist, you know, the bread and the wine. And the imam pulled out an apple. And so the Pope said, the Muslims win, they can stay. So the bishop, the cardinals went to the Pope. They said, what had just happened? And he said, well, I told them they have to believe in the Trinity. And he said, but you still believe God is one. And that's true. And then I told them that God is in heaven, and he reminded me, but his justice has to apply in the earth. And then I told him, you have salvation through the sacrament of communion. And he reminded me, but we all share the sin of Adam. So the Muslims all went to the imam and they said, what just happened? He said, you have 3 days to get out of town. I said, we're not leaving, not one of us is leaving. And then he said, we'll tear down your houses. I said, we'll sleep on the floor. And then he said, he brought out his lunch, so I brought out mine. So, the moral of that story is that we can be talking to each other and completely misunderstanding each other. And when it comes to religion, there's an immense amount of miscommunication going on. Now, one of the things that we in the West pride ourselves on is that we're no longer a missionary civilization. We're not out proselytizing. But we forget much of our religious fervor has been transferred from religion to secularity. And I come from a country that is in many ways a fundamentalist administration right now, that is preaching the gospel of democracy and spreading it by gun. Because that's what happened in Iraq. They went there to bring democracy to these people. They didn't ask the Iraqis, do you want democracy? Should we take a poll? Can we bomb you, kill 100,000 of your civilians, but you'll get to vote after the war's over? Do you want to make that deal? Is that a deal? That's pretty democratic, just to ask the Iraqis if they want the Americans to invade so that they'll destroy their infrastructure and then rebuild it with immense contracts from place like Halliburton and things like that, but Iraqi oil will pay for it, so it'll all work out. Now, in the Muslim world, there's a lot of that experience. That's how people feel. We're being told what to do, what to believe. Our school books are being rewritten based on the Rand Report. You know, based on an American think tank on what we should believe, how we should be informed, what our religion should say. And certain types of Islam are completely unacceptable. Now, I'm, for instance, don't adhere to the Islam, or at least one aspect of the Islam that's so unpleasant to a lot of people in the West, but I don't deny the right to adhere to what they believe. I mean, if that's what they believe, that's what they believe. I would draw the line, obviously, on violence towards other people. That's unacceptable, aggressive violence, attacking innocents, civilians, all those things. Most Muslims that I know, fortunately, in fact, I would say all the ones that I consider my friends, are opposed to that. That's one of the fundamental principles in Western civilization. I grew up with the First Amendment in the United States, which is freedom to worship as you see fit. Well, now, the same country that heralds that as one of its highest principles is telling Muslims how they should be worshiping because they don't see fit certain ways of worshiping, certain attitudes. So we have to recognize the paradoxes of the time we're living in. When I was in England a few days ago, a historian who I don't agree with, and I want to make that very certain, a historian got 3 years for denying the Holocaust. 3 years in prison. Sentenced to 3 years in prison for denying the Holocaust. I mean, freedom of speech stopped at some point because he didn't do anything. He didn't kill anybody or harm anybody. He just wrote a book that apparently was very well footnoted and documented, and he said this didn't happen. He was given 3 years in prison. Why? Because there are laws in Europe that do not allow people to deny the Holocaust. So it's very interesting that it's not seen as a criminal act to incite to religious hatred, or that we don't interpret that as incitement to religious hatred. Because if I depict a person that one out of every five people holds to be sacred as somebody evil, I would say that is incitement. Because putting that message out there in a society in which we have reasonably large numbers of people that follow that faith, that is going to, in turn, cause some people to start thinking, all these Muslims here in Denmark, all of you are terrorists. And prejudice occurs. A lot of things happen from that. So it's really important that we in the West, and I'm talking about we in the West, not just Muslims, we in the West have to recognize some of the inherent contradictions that we have and the fact that we have not resolved all of the issues. In the Muslim world, we have a whole other kettle of fish. One of the major problems is our immense lack of consistency. We're not consistent about things. In the Muslim world, Muslims will, for instance, what the American tele-evangelists, some of them, said about the Prophet Muhammad was far more odious than these satirical cartoons. in my estimation, far more odious. There was little or no response from the Muslim world. I mean, there has to be a question why some things affect them and why other things don't. Is Denmark an easy target? Is it easier to, you know, I mean, the fact that there's other types of cheese in the market, so I'm just not going to pick Danish cheese. Whereas when it comes to America, you know, the Boeing plane is an important plane for Arab airlines. A lot of them use Boeing. There's no call to boycott Boeing. It's an American company. I mean, what America is doing in many ways, one would think that there would be calls to boycott. And there have been, but they haven't been very successful. But my point is, there's not a consistency. There really isn't. And then the other thing is, the very thing that Muslims criticize the West for doing, which is taking the Muslim world to account for the actions of 19 people, the Saudi Arabians consistently say, so what if there were 15 out of the 19 Saudi Arabians? That has been repeated so many times in Western media, it would probably fill several volumes if you just took all the quotes of that was used. Well, haven't you heard the 15 out of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia? It's almost irrelevant in the West that if you look where they were from areas that are largely tribal, that don't really represent the majority of Saudi Arabians. The Saudis don't want to be blamed for what 15 people that happen to be from Saudi Arabia did. They don't want to be blamed for that. And so it's very ironic that there are Muslims blaming the entire nation of Denmark for something that an editor approved of and some cartoonists did. A handful of cartoonists. The Quran says, لَا تَزِرُ وَازِرَةٌ وِزْرَ أُخْرَى. No sin, no soul bears the sins of any other soul. We don't believe in Islam in collective guilt. That is an alien concept in the Islamic tradition. We have no collective guilt. And so it's very important. We've alienated largely a very decent people. I mean, my experience, one of the things that really surprises me is almost every Danish person that we have dealt with since I got here has a big smile on their face. Genuinely warm people that have been very helpful. And why should we alienate them from our religion, from our Prophet ﷺ? I would rather inform them about what we are as opposed to what we are not. We are constantly identifying ourselves by what we are not. Muslims have become a community that is caught up in an identity politics. The identity politics of the pre-Islamic Arabs was known as Hamiyya. Hamiyyatul Jahiliya. The zeal of the Jahili period. The word in Arabic for Jahil, it doesn't mean ignorant. Jahil actually has a comprehensive meaning. And one of the basic and fundamental meanings is the Jahil is opposite the Halim. The Halim is a forbearing person. It's somebody who's patient, who will actually listen to abuse and not return it with abuse. The Quran says, وَيَدْرَؤُونَ بِالْحَسَنَاتِ السَّيِّئَةِ اِدْفَعْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنِ. The Quran says, وَاصْبِرْ عَلَى مَا يَقُولُونَ وَهْجُرْهُمْ هَجْرًا جَمِيلًا. The Quran says, وَإِذَا خَاطَبُهُمُ الْجَاهِلُونَ قَالُوا سَلَامًا. The first ayah, and they return wrongs with rights. The Prophet said, أَتْبِعَ السَّيِّئَةَ الْحَسَنَةَ تَمْحُهَا. Follow up a bad deed with a good deed, and it will obliterate the bad deed. Because goodness is much more powerful than evil. The Quran says it commands to repel wrong with what is better. Not with what's worse, with what is better. The Quran says, and when fools speak to them, they say peace. They say peace. أَفْشُوا السَّلَامُ بَيْنَكُمْ. The first khutbah the Prophet ﷺ gave in Medina, according to Abdullah bin Salam, the Jewish man from another tradition who came to hear, what did this man have to say? What was the essence of his message? He went to his talk, and the Prophet, the first thing he said, Ya Yuhannas, humanity, speaking to everybody, not just the Muslims, everybody, because the message of the Prophet Muhammad is to everybody. The Muslims have become covetous of Islam. This is ours. You see, I mean, that's all the Muslims have. It's just holding on. This is ours. You can't have it. Well, I'm here to say we can have it because I have it. And I wasn't born a Muslim. Islam is for anybody who wants it, but first and foremost, it's an invitation. It's a da'wah. Da'wah is not proselytizing. It's inviting. If you want to invite people to a da'wah, da'wah in Arabic is it's a dinner. It's a madaba. You know, it's a dinner. If you want to invite people for dinner, you prepare the table. When they come, you don't spit on them. Really, you don't spit on them. You prepare the table. You make it beautiful. Sit down. Marhaban. Willkommen. Ahlan wa sahlan. You know, really, that's what you're supposed to do. Sit down. Even if they speak ill of you. Wasbir ala ma yaqulu. Be patient about what they say. You will hear much from those who were given the book before you that is odious to you. Forgive them. Overlook. Fasbahu. Wa'fu. Forgive them and overlook. لَإِنْ صَبَرْتُمْ لَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لِلصَّابِرِينَ عَاقِبُوا بِمِثْلِ مَا عُقِبْتُمْ بِهِ لَإِنْ صَبَرْتُمْ وَخَيْرٌ لِلصَّابِرِينَ Yes, repel. If somebody harms you, you have a right to defend yourself. But those who are forbearing, who are patient, that is better when they show patience. And there are Muslims that say these verses are abrogated. Then there's no religion of Islam. If you say these principles that are the highest ethical principles on the planet are abrogated by Ayatul Sayyid, you've basically said that Islam is not a moral religion. And I reject that. Fakhruddin al-Razi rejected it. The great mufassirun of our tradition, and the fact that there's even a debate about it within the mufassir community is indicative of it can't be abrogated because it would have to be mujma'alay, and there are only about 6 ayahs in the entire Quran that are agreed upon as abrogated. All the other ones are debated. Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah said, there is no verse that was abrogated except that it applies when the same conditions in which it was revealed are existent. So it's the conditions that determine. I think we as a Muslim community have failed to live up to the honor of the Prophet. If you want to honor the Prophet, then internalize his character. Because he was the most kana ahlam al-nas. Really, look, read his seerah. Read his seerah. When I read his seerah, I see a man who was constantly forgiving people. People that spat on him. People that threw the entrails of a carcass on him. And he would still forgive them. In Sahih al-Bukhari, one of the Sahaba went to give da'wah to Dos. And Dos is a Yemeni tribe. He came back and he said, Ya Rasulullah, inna Dosan qad asat wa abad. They've gone in rebellion and they've rejected your message. This tribe, Dos. Fad'u alayhim. So, invoke God against them. Call God against them because they've rejected it. I went, I told them Islam and they rejected it. So the Prophet, he turned to the Qibla, استقبل القبلة. ورفع يديه وظن الناس أنه سيدعو عليهم فقال اللهم أهدي دوس وأتي بهم. Oh God, guide those and bring them to me. And from amongst them is Abu Huraira. So that was the Prophet. In the midst of the Battle of Uhud, when they'd broken his foretooth, when the chain mail had penetrated his cheek and blood was dripping down his face, they asked him to make dua against him. He said, I wasn't sent to curse people. I was sent as a mercy. Rahmatan muhda. As a merciful gift. I mean, this is the Prophet that I know. I don't know the Prophet that those cartoonists drew. They're not drawing my Prophet. They're drawing their misconceptions. And I don't know that. I don't see him in them. I don't see him in the words that people attribute to him here. And one of the things that our Prophet ﷺ said, that in every age there has to be and there will be people that carry this tradition. And he said, يَنْفُونَ عَنْهُ تَحْرِيفَ الْغَالِينَ. They will negate the misquotations of extremists. That's what Ghali means. Ghali is an extremist. They will refute the misquotations of extremists that take the Quran out of context, that take the Hadith out of context, the sayings of the Prophet ﷺ. They will refute those people. And then he said, وَانْتِحَالَ الْمُبْطِئِينَ. And the plagiarisms of people that want to negate Islam. The plagiarisms of people that want to negate Islam. With ta'wil al-jahili, and the interpretations of zealots, the interpretations of fools. So the word jahil in Arabic and the jahili age was an age of hamiya. And that is the identity politics of the pre-Islamic Arabs. Hamiya is to get angry. It's to rage. It's to go out and tear things down. It's to go and, if somebody kills one of my tribal members, I'll go out and find anybody from his tribe and kill him. It doesn't matter whether he did it or not. That's irrelevant. I'll go and find any Danish person because some Dane insulted my prophet. Doesn't matter if that Dane agreed with it or disagreed with it. I'm not even going to ask him. You're Danish? Strike him down. That's jahiliyyah. That is the essence of what our Prophet ﷺ came to remove from the world. It's the complete negation of Islam. And that's the Islam that I embraced. That's the Islam that I follow. And that's the Islam that I want to die on. It's not this other thing that I don't recognize. And the Quran says, when the people of disbelief were opposing the Prophet with their aggression, and their hearts were filled with this hamiyah al-jahiliyyah, فَأَنزَلَ اللَّهُ سَكِينَتُهُ عَلَى رَسُولِهِ وَعَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. At that point, Allah brought a tranquility upon the hearts of the believers and upon the heart of the Prophet. Sakina is the antidote for hamiyah. Tranquility is the antidote for hostility. That does not mean people don't have a right to defend themselves. It doesn't mean we have a right, don't have a right to defend the honor of our Prophet. Absolutely we do. And we should. But it has to be done in accordance with the teachings of our Prophet. You cannot honor the Prophet by dishonoring his teachings. To go and destroy a Danish embassy has nothing to do with Islam. The Prophet ﷺ honored the ambassadors. He would never kill an ambassador or harm an ambassador. It was the essence of his teaching, was the rule of law, social order. These were things he did not come to disrupt, but came actually to instill in the hearts of people, not so that they feared the law, but actually they interiorized the law. They followed the law because they recognized the right of the law. And so I really feel it's very important. I feel in some ways, I want to say to the Danish people that I am sorry that your flag was desecrated. Because that is wrong. And I don't care what was done. The people of Denmark did not do anything wrong. And I do not believe in collective guilt. Because there's people that means a lot to them. They're proud of their country, and there are many reasons why they should be proud. But I also feel that this government has to recognize the sensitivities of 1/5 of the world's population, and the fact that rudeness should never be defended. Maybe it shouldn't be criminalized. That's for the courts here to decide whether that goes under the incitement of hatred or not. That's for the courts to decide. These are not corrupt courts. They're good courts. They have good justices. They need to decide that. But what needs to be affirmed is mutual respect, cooperation, a recognition that the dignity of people should be honored, That there's no room for gratuitous insults. There's no right to spit on people. And what was done in those newspapers is far worse in the hearts of Muslims than ever being spit on. There are Muslims that would rather be killed than hear their prophet denigrated. And that's the absolute truth. And one of the great Sahaba who was in his captured by the polytheists and they were torturing him, and they said, "Wouldn't you rather now that Muhammad was in your place and you were free?" And he said, "Wallahi, by God, I would not want even a thorn to penetrate his blessed foot." That man preferred to be tortured himself. At the Battle of Uhud, there were companions of the Prophet that were jumping in the air to catch the arrows being fired upon the Prophet. Not trained by Secret Service to go against their natural impulse for self-preservation, but just out of love. And that love might be difficult for Danish people to understand in an age when religion has fallen on hard times in this country, but it's not difficult for Muslims to understand. And we need more understanding. And this should be an opportunity, because a crisis is inevitably an opportunity. And the Chinese ideogram for crisis is the same ideogram for opportunity. And so we have an immense opportunity here to understand each other at a deeper level. And that's what we're promoting. We're promoting mutual understanding. I believe in the verse of the Quran, كُلُّ مَا أَوْقَدَ نَارًا لِلْحَرْبِ أَطْفَأَهَا اللَّهُ. Every time they tried to inflame the fires of war, God put those fires out. And we should be firefighters. We should be trying to put out these fires. Not to flame them, not to throw fuel on them, but to try to put them out so that we can understand each other. Our Prophet in that khutbah in Medina said, أَفْشُ السَّلَامُ. Spread peace. وَأَطْعِمُ الطَّعَامُ. And feed each other. Feed food. Feed people. Because that's one way that you come to appreciate each other. If you want a good meal here in Copenhagen, there are people that go to a Moroccan restaurant or an Indian restaurant to have a Muslim bajin. Why haven't we made our religion as delicious as our food? Really, why haven't we made this religion as palatable as the food that Muslims make, which is good food? The reason Arabs love Danish cheese is because the Danes have worked out how to make Arab cheese better than the Arabs. That's why. And there's actually an argument historically that the Vikings learned Muslim cheese making in Spain. I'm not making that up. Because the Danes were actually defeated by the Spanish Muslims of Portugal. So there was a time when they did fight, but they ended up teaching them how to make cheese. And they came back. And now, there's a reasonably good livelihood here. And that's another reason, tijara. The Quran says, لَا تَأْكُلُ أَمْوَالَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ بِالْبَاطِلِ. Do not devour your wealth amongst you vainly. But let it be commerce that is mutually agreed upon between you. And then the Quran says, وَلَا تَقْتُرُوا أَنفُسِكُمْ لَا تَنَابَزُوا بِالْأَلْقَابِ. Don't throw names at each other. Don't kill each other. I mean, these are the commandments of our book. So I really feel like we need to be spreading more peace. I just want to conclude with a description of the Prophet. This was in a book that I wrote about the Prophet, Content of Character, which is ethical sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. But I would like just to write, to read to you a description for those of you who aren't Muslim, to maybe get... This description came from somebody who was very close to him. He said, his face was luminous as the full moon. He was taller than average, but not excessive in height. He had wavy hair, which he parted and which did not go beyond his shoulders. And he had fair skin and a wide brow. His eyes were black, his beard full, and his nose fine and aquiline. His cheeks were firm, and his teeth were brilliantly white with a small gap between the front ones. His physique was supple and lithe with a full chest and broad shoulders. His legs were powerful, his fingers slender, and his muscles fine and sinewy. When he spoke, he was always brief and reflective. He spoke when he saw benefit and spent long periods in silent contemplation. His speech was comprehensive, being neither wordy nor laconic. He had a mild temperament and was never harsh nor cruel, coarse nor rude. He expressed gratitude for everything given to him, no matter how insignificant. When he spoke, his companions lowered their heads as if birds were perched upon them. When he was silent, they felt free to speak. He never criticized food, nor praised it excessively. He never uttered obscenities, nor did he find fault in people. He did not flatter people, but praised them when appropriate. And he never repaid a wrong with another wrong, but his character was to forgive and overlook. And finally, this is from a great Victorian poet, Edwin Arnold, who wrote a beautiful poem about Islam to teach British people about Islam. In 1882, it was published. He said in the introduction, "That marvelous and gifted teacher created a vast empire of new belief and new civilization and prepared a sixth part of humanity for the developments and reconciliations which later times will bring. For Islam must be conciliated. It cannot be thrust scornfully aside or rooted out. It shares the task of the education of the world with its sister religions, and it will contribute its eventual portion to that far-off divine event toward which the whole creation moves." I really hope that in the spirit of people like Edwin Arnold, Western people that really wanted to understand Islam, I hope that that feeling spreads, that knowledge about this religion spreads, and also amongst the Muslims, that respect towards others also needs to go both ways, and I'm not denying that in any way. And finally, like the poet said, وَإِنْ عَبِقَتْ فِي الْغَرْبِ أَنْفَاسُ ذِكْرِهِ وَفِي الشَّرْقِ عَلِيلُ تَعَافَ مِنَ الضُّرِّ. Perhaps if the fragrance of his scent, the Prophet's scent, spreads in the West, you'll see Eastern people becoming well after being sick. Thank you very much.
This lecture continues with a question and answer session.
وَمَنْ انْتَصَرَ بَعْدَ ظُلْمِهِ فَمَا عَلَيْهِ مِنْ سَبِيلٍ. You know, whoever, after he's been wronged, defends himself, you can't blame him. But there's a woman عَفَى وَأَصْلَحَ فَأَجْرُهُ عَلَى اللَّهِ. But those who forgive and are forbearing, their reward is with God. So, my inclination is that our Prophet ﷺ forgave people. When at the Battle of Uhud, in the midst of all that, I was mentioning earlier and didn't get to the point, he said, when he was asked to curse them, he said, "Allahumma ahdi qawmi fa'innahum la ya'lamun." Guide my people because they don't know what they're doing. Well, from one point of view, they knew exactly what they were doing. So what was he talking about? I think what he meant by that is they don't know they're opposing a prophet. That they genuinely, in their own minds, they don't realize what they're doing. And the proof of that is many of those same people became Muslim at the end of the affair. So I'm opposed to collective guilt. One question said that the majority of Tayyans agree with the cartoonists. I think you have to be very careful when you make a statement like that, because I think what, if they did polls, I think what they agree with is the right to satire. I don't think they're agreeing that it's a good thing or that it's about the right. And that's something in the West we have to recognize. There is a very different set of references that are informing people in the West. The right, freedom of speech in the West is meaningless if you cannot criticize religion and politicians. Because historically, that's what the right was fought for. It was the right to criticize religion. People were burnt at the stake if they even disagreed with the Catholic Church. And so that was a long struggle to get to that point. Now, unfortunately, it has been degraded
this right to the point where it's simply a right to insult, to say degrading remarks. I personally don't think that right should be defended. Maybe it shouldn't be criminalized in the West. That's for Western societies to determine for themselves. But I don't think it should be defended in that way. It should be said, we believe that this is not in the spirit of discourse, of civilization, that it's antithetical to the highest principles of Danish culture, which really promotes respect, things like that. I think if it was framed like that, it would have been much more effective. But unfortunately, people got by their secular guns and, you know, we're going to defend this right, even if it's the right to insult. I don't think the right to insult should be defended. Maybe people have that right to insult, but it shouldn't be defended in that way, that we stand up for it. We can say, well, he's entitled to his opinion. I don't agree with what he said. In other words, insulting people's religion. I think so it's important how the questions were framed. I personally, Danish people seem incredibly polite to me. I mean, that's been my experience in Denmark, at the restaurants, at the hotels, at the airport. They seem incredibly polite people, and I just find it hard to believe that they want to insult people, because I've never been insulted in my 3 visits to Denmark. I've never been insulted by a Dane. And so I find that hard to believe. But defending the right to satire, I think probably many Danes feel that that should be defended. So I think we have to be very careful. Now, I do know that there is a very troubling development in Danish politics, which is the rise of a right, an extreme right. And unfortunately, that rises. I find it very troubling for a country that took such incredibly beautiful positions during the Nazi occupation. I mean, this country should be proud of, you know, its fathers and mothers that took the positions that they did, because they were deeply opposed to Nazism, and that's something that Denmark should be very proud of. So it's very troubling to see extreme right positions, but that is still a minority and marginalized minority, and we don't want to see that increase. And it's unfortunately responses like some of the responses from the Muslim world that gives fuel to that extreme right agenda. So I think we have to be very careful in promoting those types of things. So they are firm, standing hard, defending freedom of speech. Shouldn't we too stand hard defending the Prophet? We should absolutely defend him. But I think the best way to defend his honor is to actually live his religion, is be a shaheed to his truth. But if you think that defending his religion is tearing down embassies or calling people to wanton violence, I don't see that. I don't understand that. And the Quran reciter recited a beautiful, beautiful recitation when this began, and he said, "Inna shani'aka huwa al-abtar." The one who hates you is cut off from divine sustenance, and that's the Muslims believe that. That's a Quranic belief. We believe that. But shani, the root word of shani, is to hate. And there's another verse in the Quran that uses that same word. لَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَلَّا تَعْدِلُوا اِعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى. Do not allow the loathing of a people. شَنَآنُ, it's the same as إِنَّ شَانِئَكَ, it's the same root. Do not allow the loathing of a people for you to prevent you from being just. Be just, adhere to justice. So it's very important. لَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ, you know, don't let them take you into doing things that are criminal or beyond the law. So I think that's really important for people to do that. Don't you think that it's important for the scholar to or the world to understand the difference between real Islam and this pseudo-Islam? and that this is an obligation of the Muslims. Absolutely, I do believe that. I mean, بَلِّغُ عَنِّي وَلَوْ آيَةٍ, teach people what I said, even if it's a verse. So I think it's very important. And again, I really feel like we as Muslims have failed to spread the, you know, we forget. Our belief is that the world is Ummatul Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. There's two ummahs. There's Ummat al-Da'wah and Ummat al-Istijaba. And I'll tell you something that Imam al-Ghazali said, rahimahullah, in Faisal al-Tafriqa, which is a very important book about the nature of kufr. But in that book he said there are three types of disbelievers or people that reject Islam. He said the first type are people that live and see the beauty of Islam and reject it. And he said those people, according to the Quran, are finnar. He said the second group are people that live near the lands of Islam. He said they're mixed. He said the third people are people that live far away. And he said those people often are raised since the time they're little with a distorted version of Islam. They're told that a false prophet came and that he claimed to be a prophet and he wasn't. And he said those people are not rejecting Islam. They're rejecting a false image of Islam. And so they are not taken to account for that. That's Imam al-Ghazali said that. Because he said they're not rejecting what they understand to be true, which is the nature of kufr. It's when you recognize a truth and you reject it. And so it's very important to understand that many, many people have a very distorted version of Islam. And unfortunately, we have Muslims that confirm that version. And I'll tell you another thing. Ibn Taymiyyah, and this is in a book called Jawab al-Sahih, fi raddi ala man badra din al-Masih. In this book, Ibn Taymiyyah, it's in volume 1, Ibn Taymiyyah said, one of the great tragedies of the Muslims today, and this is, he's writing in the 8th century Islamic era, so this is almost 800 years ago. He said, one of the great tragedies of Muslims today is when Christians ask them or have doubt about the religion of Islam, because it's a religion that's spread by violence. I mean, this is what he said, that they think Islam spread by violence. He said, instead of explaining them that Islam spread by proofs and intelligent dialogue and discourse, they say, مَنْ أَعْطِكَ الْجَوَابِ إِلَّا سَيْفِ. The only answer you'll get from us is violence. So Ibn Taymiyyah was complaining about the Muslims of his age, and he said, يَرُدُّونَ بِمَا يَحْتَجُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ النَّصَارَى. Their response is the very thing that the Christians are attacking them for. And he said, how can we get anywhere? Why don't we listen to the Quran says, وَجَادِرُهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنُ. Debate with them in the best way, in the most beautiful way. Ahsan means the most virtuous way, the most beautiful way, the highest way. That's how we should be speaking to them. Not, you know, responses with violence. And this is a problem. See, I mean, I believe until the Arabs need to change their grammar books. Because the Arabs learn grammar. And when I learned grammar, it was Dick sees Jane, which is a problem in the West. Right? That's how little kids here learn grammar. Dick sees Jane. The boy sees the girl and then falls in love and tragedies occur. In the Arab world, they say, ضرب زيدٌ عمرا. Zayd hit Omar. That's what they learn. I'm not making that up. So they need to change their grammar books. Because we don't want cultures that encourage hitting somebody. There was a Mauritanian who learned fiqh before he learned grammar, which some Mauritanians do. And then he went to learn grammar and he knew Islamic jurisprudence. So the grammarian sat down and he said, the first thing I'm going to teach you is jumla, fi'liya. ضرب زيد عمرا. Zayd hit عمرا. And then this man who'd learned jurisprudence, he said, why did he hit him? He said, no. It's not important. He said, well, how is it not important? Maybe he oppressed him. We should help عمرا if Zayd is oppressing him. And then he said, no, it's not real. He said, what do you mean it's not real? He said, it didn't happen. He said, you're lying to me? He said, don't you know it's haram to tell a lie in Sharia? What what are your comments to what the mullah in Afghanistan said about killing a Dane, giving a big reward? I mean, that's not a mullah that would say, I'm sorry. It's no mullah would say that in Afghanistan, I guarantee. I mean, we have one of the Mujaddidi family from Afghanistan. Would a mullah say that in Afghanistan to go kill a Dane? Yeah, no, he's not a mullah. It's jahiliyyah. That's the essence of jahiliyyah. So whoever said that is somebody unfortunately caught up in just the hamas of the moment, this zeal, and not seeing. Why do you refer to Islam as a religion? Is the meaning of deen in Arabic not to owe, to be in debt? Therefore, can religion be applied to Islam?
I've been told that you have to go soon.
Okay, there's two more questions. Great. So, is religio in Latin means that which binds together. And we get the word in English ligament. You know, your ligaments that bind your muscles together. It's from the same root. So I'm using it as an aqidah, because aqidah in Arabic is that which ya'qiduka, it binds you. So it's the same basic meaning. So Muslims share a creed, and in that way Islam is a religion. It's something that holds a group of people together with shared beliefs. So I don't have a problem with that. Deen could be translated as a way of life, a religion, a debt owed to God, transaction. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do it. Arabic's a rich language, so you just have to apologize for, I mean, the Arabs have 500 words for a lion, for literally lion. So they have, they say the Eskimos have a lot of words for snow, which is not true. I actually read an essay in a linguistic book that said there were only about 10 words for snow in Eskimo. So that's not true. But the Arabs really do have a lot of words for things, and milla is one of the words they use for religion. This is, how do you balance between forbearance, patience, and between izzah? Izzah is like your dignity or your honor. So how do you balance between those two? Well, the Arabs have a lot of poems where they talk about, like فَمَنْ شَأَ تَعْوِيجِ فَإِنِّي مُعَوَّجُ وَمَنْ شَأَ تَقْوِيمِ فَإِنِّي مُقَوَّمُ. Whoever wants to make me crooked, I'll be more crooked than he can make me. And whoever wants to, make me straight, I'll be straighter than he can imagine. So, unfortunately, that is a cultural phenomenon that many of the Muslim peoples have inherited, this idea of, أَلَا يَجْهَلَنْ أَحَدٌ عَلَيْنَا فَنَجْهَلَ فَوْقَ جَهَلَ الْجَهَلِينَ. One of the pre-Islam poets said, if anybody is ignorant with me or shows me zeal, I'll be twice as ignorant with him and show him even more. I mean, those aren't Islamic virtues or qualities. وَمَا أَنَا إِلَّا مِنْ غَزَيَةِ إِنْ غَوَيْتُ وَإِنْ تَرْشُدْ غُزَيَةُ أَرْشُدِي. I'm from Hosea, the tribe of Hosea. As long as Hosea's guided, I'm guided. And if Hosea goes astray, I go astray. I mean, that's tribalism. It's not Islam. So I'm very opposed to that. What would you advise young Muslims to do regarding the situation? I think, first of all, the Muslim community needs to really be engaged with the dominant community. I think that we need to be more active as a community. Support your organizations, the reasonable ones that are doing good things. We have to live together. And I want our women, especially the women that are wearing hijab, I don't want to see any of these women accosted or harmed because of religious display. But unfortunately, when you attack a Dane, some foreign country, in a Muslim country, there's Danes here that see a Muslim and they think, oh, I have to do it. That's jahiliyyah. And you create these cycles of violence. And Islam came to break cycles of violence. Our Prophet ﷺ came to break these inna dima'a al-jahiliyyati mawdu'a. The blood of jahiliyyah is over. You can't claim any jahili blood. And the blood of jahiliyyah was what they called thaar. In fact, in Iraq, there was a group called the Thaar Brigade. And that's what the name they gave was, a jahili name. But Thaar isn't even an Islamic concept. It's a jahili concept. So this is unfortunately how far some of our co-religionists have followed. So I think it's very important for people to be engaged. I really think that there has to be interaction with the government because this has brought into the forefront some real rifts and problems that need to be understood and developed so that they can be dealt with. So I think it's very important for us to think deeply about what this means to us as a community and how, again, we can bridge some gaps. That's very important. I think you need people to write opinion, op-ed pieces. You need people that should be engaged with the media. People like Sidi Abdul Wahid that are out there doing it. I think it's very good to put some of the Danish, people that have long-standing roots in this country, to put some of those people forward to let Danes know that it's not just immigrants, that they're actually people that were born and come from a long line of Danish people that are Muslim. So the religion is a Danish religion. It's not an imported religion in that way. It's part of Danish culture. Ibn al-Fadlan, I don't know if you're aware of Ibn al-Fadlan, but he visited Scandinavia during the Abbasid Caliphate in Iraq and wrote a beautiful history of what they were like, what type of people, and it was before a lot of the civilization, the civilizing effects of Christianity had come, but nonetheless, there were people in the pre-modern world that traveled and wanted to know about people. Ibn Battuta is an example of that. So it's important for, I think, some of the Muslims here to invite the Danes into your places of worship, the religious centers, especially people that have an impact on the society. I think you should reach out, especially at the college level, to get lecturers and people going out and speaking to people. I think you should do maybe have ta'rif al-nabi yawm, a day of teaching people about the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Teach people about who he was, really, because people need to know. Muslims need to know, because I think a lot of Muslims have forgotten who he was and have a very distorted understanding of what he is and was. So I think it's really important. I believe that this is a time in which there are many verses in the Quran. The Quran is a book, لِكُلِّ مَقَامٍ مَقَامٍ. The Arabs say every condition has appropriate words. And I believe the essence of Islam is a call to peace. Allah يَدْعُو إِلَى دَارَ السَّلَامِ. He's calling to the abode of peace. اُدْخُلُ فِي السَّلَمِ كَافَ. Come into this abode of peace. You know, Islam calls to peace, and that's why at the essence of this religion is a desire for peace. The Prophet ﷺ, in his dua after every single prayer, five times a day, he said, "Oh Allah, I ask you for peace. Let me live in peace. Let me die in peace. Let me be raised up in peace." So peace is very important. It's a beautiful term. And I hope that we afshu salam bainakum, you know, that we are people that spread peace. We want to live together peacefully, and we want to be respected, but we should also respect others. It's a two-way street, respect and mutual respect. You have to have two, you know, the Arabs say, yadun wahida la tusaffaq. You know, one hand can't clap. And like Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayyah said in London, وَلَازِمْ اثْنَيْنِ لَلْتَنْغُ. You know, you have to have two to tango. So he said, that's not our culture. Our culture is you need two hands to clap. Your culture, two to tango. But the point is, it's a two-way street. And in order to avoid collisions on a two-way street, you have to obey the law. And part of the law is not just the formal laws that are written in the books, but it's the norms of society. It's those aspects of society that are desirable, right? It's like your high beams on. You turn your high beams on when you see somebody coming down the road. You could leave your high beams on, but you turn them off out of respect for that person because he's driving in the opposite direction and you don't want to blind him with your light. So you turn the light down a little bit. So I think that's what we need to recognize. It is a two-way street, and you know, people can make U-turns. So if people want to join the Muslim road, I mean, we hope we're going to a good place. You know, so if people want to make that U-turn, we should have the courtesy to stop and let them make that U-turn instead of smashing their car because they're getting in our way. I really appreciate your attendance and your patience with the microphone and everything. I thank especially people, you know, that aren't Muslim that have come out trying to better understand where we're coming from. And I really meant what I said. There are good people here. I really like the Danish people. And I wish you the best. I have no other feelings but the best for you. I really wish you the best. I do hope that you find out more about Islam. I hope that the Muslims are beautiful mirrors of our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, of his character, of his high moral stature. The Quran says, وَإِنَّكَ لَعَلَى خُلُقٍ عَظِيمٍ. Truly you are in a vast moral character. And that vastness should be widely spread and disseminated. So may Allah increase all of you. Thank you very much for this evening. And Sidi Abdul Wahid, thank you for your time. And I think they mentioned that inshallah everybody who wanted to give a book to everybody who came as a gift. And also we're going to make them available for people in the government. I really feel that the government needs to have a deeper understanding and really recognize that we don't have to clash, but we will clash if we don't respect each other. It's as simple as that. There's a young girl world that we're going to wake up in if we really don't work to educate ourselves, to inculcate virtue and moral in each other's behavior, and to have some mutual respect. And also to avoid stepping on each other's toes. Really, to avoid that. I mean, the Arabs say, al-fitnatu na'imatun. This is a hadith, actually. The Prophet Muhammad said, al-fitnatu na'imatun. فَلَعْنَ اللَّهُ مَنْ أَيْقَضَهَا. The sedition, civil strife is asleep. May God damn the one who wakes it up. Civil strife, people fighting each other. May God damn the one who wakes that up. And so we want the fitna to remain sleeping. If it does wake up, we want to try to get that bunge in there, you know, the anesthesia, you know, get it back to sleep. And that's what I'm here for. I came here, I just want to see things calm down. I think we have to address the issue. It's an important issue. I love the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. I really truly hope, I don't want to make any claims, but I hope that I would give my life for him. And so the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, ala al-ayn wa ras, like the Prophet, the Arabs say, I mean, he is nothing is over the Prophet except God himself in my order of priorities. And so I am in no way diminishing his haqq or his honor, but I really feel that we need to go to a higher level of discussion and discourse and just try to avoid brawls. Salaam alaikum.
For more lectures by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf and other traditional scholars, please contact Alhambra Productions toll-free at 1-877-888-8273 and on the internet at www.alhambraproductions.com. For more information on traditional Islam in America, please contact Zaytuna Institute at 510-582-1979 and on the internet at www.zaytuna.org.